You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. Author and magician William Hall joins me to discuss a poltergeist case that caused pandemonium in the town of Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1974. Dismissed as a hoax by the local police after 4 days of chaos, William proves that that was simply an excuse by the police department to calm the community, and the Bridgeport poltergeist was anything than a clever hoax. But before we join William, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my latest patron, Cassandra, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show with your contributions. Thank you. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes, and our exclusive merchandise is available through TeePublic, and the link for that is in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. A tragic tale of poltergeists, grief, and social suffocation awaits us in Bridgeport. ...1974, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and a quiet home and loving family faced down an unexpected visitation that seemed to be an overdue of explosion of pent-up emotion. What happened next became a poltergeist case that has been overlooked for far too long, but thankfully, my guest, William Hall, has forensically analysed this case, interviewing as many of the original witnesses, and covered the whole case in two brilliant books. William, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Absolute pleasure. I'm struck, first of all, William, because you are a magician by trade, and often people would suggest that magicians and the paranormal are usually not the best bedfellows, as often many a skeptic will come from the magic circle, trying to disprove as many sort of supernatural phenomena as possible. And so for me, you're quite unique in that aspect, especially in regards to this particular case.
Well, thank you. I was quite surprised, though, because when the book on the case came out, I was very much aware of how the magic community might respond to me. And I was wondering if I would be now the wacko or... and I was quite surprised that, as you probably know, and as you find, when people find out that you're okay, that you're open, you believe in this, then they share their stories. And I was having the same result from magicians, too. I think magicians are much more skeptical, myself included, when it comes to things like moving things with your mind, you know, bending keys, you know, those kinds of things. I think when it comes to like a poltergeist case or the paranormal in general, you find a little bit more acceptance. Obviously, it's nuanced. But it's that way with all of us. You know, some of us don't believe in Bigfoot at all. Some of us believe in all of it and just don't have the answers, which is more my side of the fence. You know, I definitely know the paranormal is real. I just don't have all the answers.
Yeah, absolutely. But as you've said in previous interviews and in some of your previous books, you've outed hoaxes. You've proved sleight of hand, how things can be manipulated. And so if anybody's going to add a bit of depth to a case such as the Bridgeport haunting, it's going to be somebody with your sort of skill set, because you know all the tricks. You know what people can and can't do. And this is often put forward when we look at numerous poltergeist cases that tend to surround a young child or a prepubescent teenager. We're often the sort of kindling for these paranormal fires to break out in certain locations all around the world. Was it one of those aspects that even as a child, you were aware of this case. Why did it take so long for it to get under your skin to the point that you went back in time? Because for you to have undertaken the level of research and interviews that you've done in both of the books covering this, it's an incredible undertaking that I don't think a modern case of its similarity has received prior to this, William.
Right. No, that's very true. Well, what took so long was the internet. I was never, I wondered about it, but I was never drawn to it enough to take the effort to go look into it during the time. And many had, and there it was limited to really the answers that they can get, because nobody was talking about it while the family was alive. But one day I happened to see a Facebook post, anybody remember the house on Lindley Street? And it occurred to me, I never really looked into it. And now with the internet, I was able to Google some newspaper articles. And that was the beginning of seeing the quotes by the police officers and firefighters. And then after reading the articles, I felt even if this was a hoax, there's a heck of a story here. It'd be interesting to find out what happened. And in one of the articles, it mentioned the name of Boyce Beatty, who was there helping the family and doing interviews. And I thought that was rather odd that the police were cooperating with this, and it was after the hoax. It was very strangely worded in the paper, but you can see what it was. And it had died down by the time that they had that in the paper. And I looked up Boyce Beatty, and I said, I talked to Joe Tomic, the first responding police officer, and he told me that he was forced to be interviewed, pulled off the street to be interviewed after it was determined a hoax. And that's what really excited me to say, this seems worthy of looking into. And I asked Boyce, Joe Tomic said that there was tons of tapes and interviews and things like that. And he said, oh, yeah, yeah. And I said, do you have any idea where they are? He's like, I think so. They're in a box in my basement. Yeah, so he said, here, go at it, and handed me the box of, it was 22 cassette tapes and an 8-hour reel-to-reel from the Bridgeport Police Department. And then I added about another 10 hours of interviews with some of the original people that were there and then new people that weren't interviewed previously. So it was quite lucky to have that kind of find, because it was one of the first times we had multiple people describing the same incident. Not just one or two, but sometimes a room full of people. So it was the corroborating evidence really helps with misinterpretation, because that's the other end of it. You know, I find more, unless you're talking about displays of psychic kind of things, I find more misinterpretation by good people than fakery. In these things. So, and some of the misinterpretation comes down to words too, because, you know, a levitation and a suspension are two different things, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, things like that. And if you ask somebody what they saw, they're going to tell you what their experience was versus what they actually saw step by step. But what amazed me in this case is the investigators did such a great job with the way they questioned the witnesses. Boyce would ask, the person would say the experience. The table picked itself up and flipped over. Mm. And so then Boyce would be like, okay, wait. What is the very first thing you saw the table do? You know, and how fast did it go up, and did it turn and fall within a way that you would expect a table would, or did it do it slower or faster than you think would have been normal? Did it appear normal to you? No, he went into such detail, and I was so happy with that, because, as a magician and my words are everything. And so is it with psychology and, people seeing things, and they're going to tell you their experience. So if he stopped at the table flipped, we would have missed details, some of which made it very paranormal. And those kinds of details helped witnesses just tell exactly what they saw versus their experience, you know, of what they saw. So that was incredible.
What was your personal experience in regards to poltergeists prior to this, Bill? Is it one of those cases? Because I've got a similar thing where I stumbled across a case several years ago, which is why I'm sat here today, because it was an incredible poltergeist case that I'd never heard of, and I didn't understand why more people didn't know about it. And that was kind of the catalyst for me basically embracing my strange side in full, finally, after sort of holding it off for as long as I could throughout my life. Was Bridgeport your one in that regard?
Yes.
You know, like I said, you had an interest in this subject previously, but was this the poltergeist case that grabbed you?
Yes, this is the case that really grabbed me. It was it was better than me experiencing it myself without anyone else seeing it. Then I would have wondered if I went crazy. In fact, I have an astrophysicist friend, Mark D'Antonio, a very intelligent guy. And you bring him on a case, we call him the resident buzzkill, because he's always trying to disprove everything no matter what. But that's great. You got to have somebody like that out there. But he also is open-minded, too, and believes. So it's a unique mixture. But I know with him, he's always trying to duplicate the phenomena, whether it's a photo or whatever. Because, you know, you get interpretations in photos, even when you're in a generally haunted place. But to get back to your question, yeah, this is the case that really grabbed me. As far as UFOs, I was pretty heavy into them, you know, in the 80s, you know, writing Freedom Information Act and you're getting documents and International Loan Library, where you had to write to get a news article that was mentioned in a book. You know, that's what I did, because I'd read the book and I'd say, well, how do I know this is true?
Yeah.
But it sounds true. So when they mentioned a government document, I wrote it down and I ordered it and I paid for it and I got it. And then I compared it to what the book said. And, you know, that's the way I kind of determined it, because it was so fascinating. I said, well, let me see if it really is real. So then I'd order it and I'd be shocked that I'd get it in the mail. Mm-hmm. So yeah, UFOs I was into. And I knew people who had, you know, phenomena that I trusted.
Yeah.
So, although I hadn't seen it myself, so everything I saw to that date was fake, including exorcisms, you know, doing a fake exorcism.
Just ignore
them long enough. They come out of it. No. It's one method, believe it or not.
Yes. Yeah.
Or a few simple magic tricks and you know, then they know his boss. But that's not true, of course, of all cases. It tends to be the ones that they contact magicians for, though. So that's the other thing. I think we tend to get targeted by skeptics. I think Houdini might have found the real paranormal if he was searching in different places, like poltergeist cases and, you know, haunted houses versus the individuals that were coming to claiming to have power. But this was the case that this is just the case. I mean, I tell people it's like the Roswell of haunted houses.
I think this is what strikes me about this, because having read both of your books on this, it kind of reminded me that I had seen something about this probably in the 90s somewhere, Bill. I couldn't tell you if I'd read about it or whatever. And without sort of starting halfway through the story, I'll tell you what got me was Sam the Talking Cat, right? And I thought, that really rings a bell. And then I realised the Warrens were there and I thought, ah, now I'm aware of what this is. But I hadn't really remembered anything else, which is quite remarkable when we talk about some of the incidents in it shortly that went on. Because, as I said to you at the beginning, I love poltergeist cases. I grew up in a haunted house. My cousins lived with a poltergeist who was a bit of a bugger, shall we say. They had a haunted pub and he used to love terrifying the staff and the customers. The family were fine with it, but he used to do stuff like he'd make the old dial telephone. He would, the receiver would levitate upwards like a snake, and he would, they used to call him Fred. And so Fred would like make the telephone move like a snake, and the staff would just scream and run off. And then when they go back in, the receiver would be back on the telephone and be like, oh, you're just pulling his leg, until they saw it happen. And so he was always, you know, moving things about and putting things in strange places and turning televisions upside down. Nothing malicious, which you can get in some cases where it seems to escalate and escalate until things get quite hairy. As poltergeist cases go that I've read about and spoken to people about, that's probably one of the most pleasant. He was just cheeky more than anything else. But when you look at this particular case, I think one of the things people often try and do is compare cases. And whilst there are similarities with perhaps more well-known cases such as Enfield, I think other than perhaps a social dynamic that you can kind of look about stress, the rest of the case, it's got a child in it and it's got a very confined area and you've got some kind of external pressures. Other than that, the only thing that connects them is it's a poltergeist.
I see what you're saying. Well, the very small house, really, that was a conductor in itself, because the mother and the daughter didn't get along too well. And she was almost 10 when this reached its height. And she was picked on in school and beat up at school and stuck at home in the tiny house with the mother. And after about 6 weeks of that, that's when the poltergeist was at its worst.
It seems, I mean, like I said, because I've read about so many cases, when you read, because this is the brilliant thing, you give us the life before the poltergeist in the book, where we understand the dynamic between Jerry and Laura.
Yes.
And obviously they suffered a tragic loss of their first child, which was Jerry Jr.,
who
developed cerebral palsy and sadly seemed to catch an infection on a family trip and pass away, which, whether they realised it at the time or not, it's quite clear when you read through everything and read the conversations that go on throughout this particular period, Bill, that is part of this whole dynamic here. Because like you say, it's very odd when you say, oh, well, the mother and the child weren't getting on. But obviously, Marcy was adopted. Laura came from a Native American background. Marcy was also of Native American First Nations stock as well, but I think she was in Canada.
Yes.
And so, which is obviously one of the reasons why the family were allowed to adopt her, because they thought that they had that sort of kinship in regards to their heritages that would sort of cement this. But you'd also straight away realise that we're getting a child who, for whatever reason, her family didn't want her, because I think she had 8 brothers and sisters. She was the only child given up for adoption.
Well, that I found out was untrue. I did do an update, but it may not be in yours. That's what Laura had said in the interviews that she was told. Mm. There were multiple children. But Marcy was a result of a teenage pregnancy. There were no signs of abuse or anything. She was just given up for adoption because the mother couldn't deal with it. So she has a few half sisters and a half brother. So we did find out later that's what happened. She wasn't on a reservation or anything. So
it's a very convoluted story then, because obviously how she ends up with the family is obviously, as you said, because of the amount of work and the forensic details and the fact you've chased so many leads down, Bill. I don't know how you've managed to do it, because it's one of the striking things about this book is you've left no stone unturned, it would seem. You seem to have interviewed as many people who are still alive with a connection to this as you possibly could. And I think that clearly shows that you really wanted to get to the bottom of it, because whatever happens, as you mentioned earlier, there's a kernel of a brilliant story in the middle of this that the general sort of perception put forward was it was all a big hoax. Everybody was just doing things for attention. But clearly the evidence doesn't support any of that. So, like I say, you've got this stressed family dynamic with this newly adopted child in it. And obviously it seems that because of what whether they believed it or not, whatever happened with Jerry Jr. completely changed the way that Laura focused in on Marcy, because it's almost like she was terrified to even let her leave the room on her own, never mind go outside, because she was completely isolated from any sort of social connection with anybody her own age and would only have friends who would visit the house because their parents were visiting her parents.
Right. That's exactly right. Walking her to school and all of that stuff, being shy, introverted. And then obviously, you know, you get picked on just for being shy, let alone not looking like you're from the neighborhood, because she didn't. And then on top of that, having your mother who's walking you to school and walking you back to school, and you can't go over somebody's house to play unless the mother comes too. I mean, you know, that's no way to make friends, to have a chance at making friends. So
no. Absolutely. He basically painted a target on her back.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. And yeah, that parenting style was definitely from the death of their 6-year-old, Jerry Jr. And and Jerry was a good guy. You know, he allowed it, or maybe he thought it was right, too. But he seemed to be the more level-headed of the two. Laura seemed pretty hysterical overall, you know, neurotic.
I think this is one of the things, because you've got someone who's gone through a lot of trauma, because you've got someone who had a very sheltered upbringing herself as a child. Laura said she didn't have any friends. She wasn't allowed to play with people. She loses her first child. She then discovers that she's got a tumour. So she has to have an operation to deal with all that. And it's almost as if very quickly they then say they want to adopt a child. It's almost as if her grief at the loss and her own upbringing was just intensified so much that I don't think whoever they adopted, Bill, I think that child would have been encased in a bubble, whatever happened, because of whether they realised it or not, they were just terrified of losing another child. And strangely, as it turned out, they ended up losing her because of how they were.
Right, right. No, that's definitely true. And I think you're right. Any child that was in that circumstance could have put together the right formula for a poltergeist scenario, being stuck, you know, with the family and having that happen outside too. You know, the home life wasn't great, and then going to school and being picked on wasn't great. So
yeah, well, I think you're undercooking it there, because I mean she suffered a horrendous beating at school, that she's had to receive serious medical attention because she was severely beaten by another pupil. And we're talking, like you say, we're talking 10-year-old children here.
Yeah, and she was in a full soft body brace as a result of it. And she was just about to turn 10. So yeah, we're not talking. And boy beat her up in the cafeteria, and that was it. The parents weren't going to send her back to that school, so she was stuck at home for 6 weeks with the mother, and you know, being homeschooled.
I mean, as well, the other thing that strikes me is that obviously events sort of explode in November 1974. But we've got a really slow burn here. I've never come across a case where it seems as if things start happening about 3 years prior to it manifesting in full, as it were. Sort of saying, right, I've saved my energy up. Now I'm going to give you the full show. Because obviously strange things start happening in 1971, it seems.
Yes. Yeah. The 1971 to 73 were the poundings on the inside and outside of the wall, and it would follow the family room to room. And they called the police at the time. They had the firemen look at it. They had the city inspectors look at it. Nobody can figure out what it was. They ruled out construction and all the obvious things. And Jerry took pipes apart thinking an animal was in there. And, but yeah, they never did find out what was with the sounds. They ended up recording those sounds with the off-duty police officer, John Holdsworth, from across the street there. And they recorded those sounds and gave the tape to Ed Warren, who gave it to Boyce Beatty, and Boyce gave it to me. So we have a recording of the poltergeist sounds, which sounded pretty freaky to me, because luckily I heard them after I had heard so many of the interviews. If I heard them first, it wouldn't have been as impactful, of course, because I wouldn't know anything about the case or the context or anything. But they were captured on tape, and they never found out what was going on with them. And then there was other things that would happen. Jerry would confide in a friend that he, a fellow scout leader, that he thinks he's going crazy because he leaves the chair out and now it's in, door's open, now it's closed, keys were here, now they're over there. He thinks he's losing his mind. So there were things like that happening too. And then there was some heavier things before it, you know, completely exploded. But yeah, there was that activity beforehand that was that simmer, as you say.
I mean, you would suggest, I mean, I'm one of those people, but I think that poltergeist is a good sort of umbrella term for phenomena of this ilk. But I think sometimes there are different ingredients in different cases that cause this explosion. I remember I was very fortunate to speak to Guy Lyon Playfair, who was one of the key investigators of Enfield several years ago.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I love his work, yeah.
And he kind of turned me on in regards to this whole sort of energy ball theory that he had, that it basically, it sort of was like a sort of a paranormal battery that would absorb negative energy depending on a variety of circumstances. And sometimes it would explode and other times it would just trundle along and be, as Jerry was saying, sending people as if they thought they were losing their minds because it would just, you know, be doing apports and minimal things. But when it happens all the time, it starts to, like you say, you start to think, hang on a minute, is there lead in my coffee? What's going on here? And so that was the first time I kind of appreciated that whilst several different types of cases could be classed as poltergeists, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And this, as I say, because it's got such a slow burn of this sort of build-up of 3 years, essentially, the straw that breaks the camel's back, it would seem, is this beating at school and then being confined to home on top of this ongoing structure of a family unit that seems to have really suffocated Marcy into the point where I think she must have felt that she was going to explode, because not only was she terrified of going to school, she was now trapped. Even worse, she was, the binds had been tightened on her even more than she could have possibly thought.
Yes, no, I definitely agree. And the idea of an energy ball is a good analogy, because I think there were two things going on in the house. Some of the things were very directed, like picking up Marcy and throwing her across the room, very, very directed towards the person negatively. And other things, I think, were a result of that energy being there, that that wash of energy. If a little model boat moves 4 inches to the left or whatever, that may not have been a conscious move by one of these parasites, but it could also just be the overflow of energy. So I think we had those two things going on. If you subscribe to the multiverse theory, that would be, as Paulino suggests, the parallel world intersecting, crossing over worlds, which is fascinating and scary to me. I don't pretend to know the math behind it, but as they say, if you think you know quantum physics, you don't know quantum physics.
Yes, that's wise words indeed. Wise words indeed. So, as I say, we've got this weekend, November, and then all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose. And when we look at these cases, time and time again, people will always say, oh, it's the kids hoaxing it all the time. Even you read what happens in the first 48 hours, it is, without a shadow of doubt, absolutely impossible for everything to have gone on and be hoaxed. It is lunacy to even, I think, putting that excuse forward is as strange as admitting the concept of a poltergeist being a real phenomenon. Because I think to be in such a level of denial is baffling to me, because you've got two adults here who seem to be absolutely terrified. And also, most of the first incident, I like that they've gone shopping and these incidents happen. Marcy's in the car. She's not in the house, is she?
That's right. She's asleep in the car, yeah.
So what? How's it kick off? What goes wrong?
Yeah, I mean, the hoax story was, I mean, it effectively worked. I mean, certainly it didn't convince everybody, but the police were more concerned with getting their city back. The chief wanted his city back. He didn't want to have people standing around the house. You know, somebody tried to burn the house down on Thanksgiving. So, you know, things are getting really out of hand. So in their defense, you know, having the hoax story fall on their lap was, you know, a quite convenient thing. And it effectively got rid of the people. It didn't bode well for the family or, of course, the police officers that were quoted and firefighters. You know, they felt kind of thrown under the bus. But, you know, they understood it but didn't like it. But that's the thing. You can't just come out and say, hey, guess what? It's real. And you're not going to get rid of people that way. And that was, I mean, because that's really the way the case progressed. The longer this thing was going on with police coming there and firemen and, you know, going in and out of the house and, you know, taking notes and the looks on their faces. And, you know, the more this is going on, people are gathering and gathering. And if you don't have an answer, it's not going to get better. People are going to keep coming. So, you know, the good thing is the hoax story was are for the people who aren't going to do any, you know, they're not going to look at it. They're just a casual TV watcher. And it's just to get rid of the kids that didn't follow the story all the way and that kind of thing. It certainly didn't convince a lot of people, and even the media talked about it, you know, haunted house or hoax. So, you know, they knew the story just didn't seem to fit. The narrative of saying it's a hoax didn't fit the narrative of everything that was being said before that. But, you know, they were going crazy with it and begging the newspapers to please stop. But nobody that was in the house during those antics thought it was a hoax. I mean, they may have at first, you know. I mean, Joe Tomic told me when he first went in there, he's trying to figure out what the heck it was. Is it a hoax? Is it something with the house? Is, you know, they didn't really know. But nobody that was there that experienced it during the height that weekend came out and said, oh, this is a hoax. I mean, not one, not a single one. Not a single police officer, firefighter, friend, neighbor, news reporter. Nobody left the house and said, this thing's a hoax. It was only the two police officers that went in there Tuesday that saw Marcy kick the TV and called it in. And that's when the hoax story fell on the chief's lap. And he said, yeah, let's, you know, we got to do it. We got to blame it on Marcy. And I'm sure Marcy wasn't happy with the way that went too later in life. So,
I mean, yeah, I mean, this is the thing as well. When I've seen other cases like this, Bill, I've never seen a case, like I say, it's got such a slow burn into it. And then it literally goes from 0 to 60 in a second. I've never seen a poltergeist case be as fast and as frenetic over that weekend. So for anybody who's yet to read your brilliant books, where does this start on this weekend from hell for this for the family?
Well, they used to go away on the weekend. They would go to upstate New York and visit Jerry's brother, and they'd go to church and they'd go shopping, and, you know, they'd come back and that would be their day out. And so they were doing that and coming back. And it was when Laura was in the kitchen starting to prepare dinner, making some eggs, and Jerry was bringing the groceries in, and the TV ends up coming down on Laura's foot, and the chair flips over and groceries go all over the place, and, you know, Jerry's dropping stuff and running in because he, you know, he hears what's going on, and the whole place is going nuts. The sofas are opening and closing by themselves. Just very, very heavy activity. And that started the whole hell weekend, if you will, off. But like you said, this is a unique case, because activity happen even after you introduce a lot of new people, which normally stuff calms down after you introduce a lot of new people. And I'm not saying it wasn't constant activity, of course, but the fact that activity of that nature, like picking up the girl, throwing her across the room, happened with a room full of people, police officers and everything, usually you don't find that kind of heavy activity like that in an environment like that.
I mean, that first series of incidents is one of the few occasions that I'm aware of where you've got a very serious injury occurs, because this telly falls on Laura's foot and absolutely smashes two of her toes, bursts them essentially. Blood everywhere, they're having to deal with it. There's knives being thrown around in the kitchen, there's glasses shattering. It must have been, not only are you trying to deal with, for Jerry, you're seeing your beloved wife in a great deal of pain, but you've also got all these very dangerous things flying around. He's ducking down. It must have felt like they were in the Blitz or something.
Yeah, they just didn't know what was going on. It was obviously just instinct. You know, when the knife block pulled itself out from the wall and came towards him, he just instinctively, you know, caught it, thank goodness. And, you know, and luckily none of the knives hit him. But, even a picture falling off a wall, something simple could whack you in the head really bad. So, yeah, these things could be dangerous in that respect for sure. As it was in this case, Paul also got a gash in the leg from the TV. Marcy could have been really hurt. If she hit her head the right way. So these things could cause physical damage, definitely.
The other aspect of this is, as we've touched on, Bill, how quickly does this become a public spectator sport? Because the thing that I find quite amazing, and I'm sure some people will be baffled by this, because we're talking about something that happened in 1974, I've seen and read about cases all around the world that happen in sort of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, where there'll be a report of hauntings. There's some brilliant ones in Australia where people report poltergeists and all the neighbours turn up and start walking through the house. Like, hello, hi, I'm just looking for your ghost. As you know what I mean? Oh, they're all outside Ice cream man turns up and people are selling hot dogs. It's like an entertainment. I couldn't believe it when I'm reading this. And I mean, there are pictures of this. This is not anecdotal evidence. This are not people. There are hundreds of people outside this house watching. So how quickly does it get into the public that everybody in the local area goes, oh, it's the weekend, let's go to the haunted house?
Right. Well, it was pretty quick. The escalation, once police cars show up, people start taking a little interest. And then we had more police cars, and we had, they had like 10 fire trucks show up. A few fire trucks, 13 firemen. I mean, you know, so once all the emergency vehicles got there, then finally the news showed up. And from there, it just escalated. And then when Ed and Lorraine Warren were called in, Ed did get on the phone and call in the AP wire, which expanded the story. That probably shouldn't have did that, but in his defense, it probably would have reached there anyhow, which the way it was going. But it didn't take long at all. It was less than 12 hours, I'd say, when we really started to get people to form, and they had to close the road off the very next day. So this thing spread really, really fast. Although Roswell spread fast too, you know, it was 47 then, and you know, that thing spread fast. So it is remarkable how fast the right story will spread. It may not spread properly, but but it'll spread.
It just strikes me because, you know, as I've said before, there are cases here that have ended up in the news and reporters have turned up and we've had the police there. But you haven't had hundreds of people turn up looking through their windows and things. I mean, there are things like they had these stone swan planters outside the house. And these people were chipping bits off as a souvenir. I mean, and I've seen this before. I know the Amityville house essentially lost a fence because people were just turning up and pulling bits of the fence off to say they got a bit of the Amityville house.
For souvenirs. Yeah, very much typical people behavior. They were, some people were selling sodas and different things while they could out there when the crowd was at its largest. You had that sort of thing going on. And people taking sticks off of branches, pieces off of branches. And at one point when the family tried to get out of the house, they ripped Marcy's coat, pocket to her coat. Yeah, it's people are crazy. Well, as the rock stars say, don't wear a scarf because, you know, you're a souvenir and, you know, one person grabs one person grabs the other. Yeah, they don't know what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, goodness.
By the way, the monkeys actually in 1968, they threw out four dummies of themselves in a concert, just threw them out to the crowd. When they went, I guess, backstage, and then four of the dummies came out and people just tore them apart. They didn't even know they were in. You know, it took them a while to realize they were fake. They're just ripping here and ripping. So it was kind of an interesting thing to do, display of human nature. But yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you see some excitable fans. I mean, it doesn't seem to be as bad these days. But you look at some of those bits of footage from the 60s for bands like the Beatles and the Stones and the Monkees.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just, it's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. Yeah. And that's how the Poltergeist case was. It's all those people. It was the same kind of behavior. Yeah. Is to get souvenirs from it. And people were trying to, like you said, they were trying to, some people just walked right into the house. Of course, you know, they were kicked out and stuff, but, you know, people knocking on the door with a pie and stuff. Everybody trying to do whatever they could to get in to get a look, you know. All the neighbors are now your friends, you know.
Yeah. Everybody you've never spoken to suddenly wants to say hello.
Exactly.
But I suppose this also adds to the body of evidence in support of it, because dozens of people witnessed strange phenomena in this house. You know, when, as we're talking about that first weekend, Bill, where you've got Laura getting her foot smashed and knives being thrown about and things being, kitchen table being tipped over. They keep putting it back, keeps flipping over. Marcy's TV falls off the side and lands on a bed. You've got this strange obsession with curtains that yeah. Jerry says, oh, I guess, well, it doesn't like curtains because it just keeps pulling them down in every room.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would disturb me the most is the curtains coming down, having to keep putting them back up. Also, cross floating down from the wall, which that was the only time one of the police officers backed out of the house slowly, went to his car, locked the door, and wasn't going in the house again. That was the only time. The rest of the guys were brave investigators, and they really didn't, you know, scream ghosts. They were trying to figure it out. So they really were also commendable with the way they approached it. When they saw the refrigerator float, they went and checked underneath and checked the basement and on top. And, you know, they didn't know what it was. But quite fascinating the way that evolved.
Well, you've also got, like I say, because you've got so many people just staring through the windows. There was dozens of the people outside who saw the fridge. And I think, was it the settee as well? One of the settees decided to, it liked moving around as well. And you got, like you said, they got this weird setup in their front room where they'd all got a recliner chair, hadn't they? They were basically, it was almost as if they were clapping these chairs because they kept folding
and
unfolding.
Opening and closing, yeah, in unison, yeah.
No, thank you.
That I know. That's incredible power for poltergeist thing. I mean, at one point, Paul had said he was getting angry at it, and he was very angry, and it was feeding on that, and the whole place filled up with this ozone smelling, you know, gauzy like smoke, and he got them all out of the house. But yeah, really, it really fed and responded on that. And between Laura and Marcy, they're the perfect conduits for that kind of situation to evolve. Yeah.
I mean, as I mentioned earlier on, I was talking about Sam the Talking Cat. And I think this is one of those things that often in this day and age, Bill, someone will pull something out of the case without any context, I think. And so say, oh, this is this case. And so nobody ever saw the cat speak. It wasn't like its little mouth was going up and down and it was talking.
Right.
But I love the description of this cat seemed to have the language of a dirty sailor. Because it would sort of shout abuse at people and say, go on, let me out. But this voice seemed to be emanating from the area near the cat rather than the cat speaking. And I think, do you think that's one of the things that, unless you look at the original case notes and the interviews, Bill, that people are going to misappropriate that actual part of it? Because the cat didn't actually talk. There was just sounds that seemed to come from wherever the cat was.
Right. I mean, some people believe the cat actually talked, but yeah, I think you really have to look at the context of it. I mean, there was audio phenomena in the case, and I think it's just, as you said, I think it's just a proximity effect. You know, the cat's there. You hear help when Marcy flies across the room, and, you know, you swear the cat said it. So I think that's what it amounts to. I don't think the cat actually talked. No, but you're right. That would be something that somebody would say. Oh, the cat talked? No, it's the hoax. You know. But again, you know, investigation by proclamation, as Stan Friedman said, doesn't impress me much.
I mean, one of the other aspects. I think this is one of the first instances that Paul Eno's involved in a case, because he was still a student at this time, and obviously he was an associate of the Warrens. Did they invite him to join him? Because I know this is the thing that people say, because they got there within what, 24 hours?
Yes.
Something like that. Primarily because somebody rang him and said, oh, you need to come, this is the real thing. And they said, oh, well, we're very busy. And they said, well, hang on, the police have had to block the street off because there's hundreds of people here, it's all kicking off. And they just dropped everything and came and fetched Paul with them.
Yeah, what happened is they went, Paul was coming over there. They had read an article Paul did and really liked it, and so contacted him. And that's how they, you know, became friends. And they invited Paul over. It was his Thanksgiving break, and he was going to go over for dinner. And Lorraine is supposedly was an amazing cook, so he's looking forward to it. And he ended up getting a flat tire to start with.
Yes.
And then by the time he got there, Ed and Lorraine were just returning. They had picked up Father Charbonneau. And that's when they got Paul Eno in the car, and he didn't have dinner. Instead, he was shoveled off to Lindley Street. And it took them like over an hour to get there with all the people. They had to walk forever to get to the house too, and park, you know, like you're going to see some crazy popular venue. But yeah, that's how Paul got involved in it. He got there expecting dinner, and Lorraine said, are you in a strong spiritual state? And, you know, and he's like, oh, God, what does this mean?
So, not unless I've eaten. No.
Yeah.
Blimey. I suppose as well that this is the thing, that we get all this stuff that goes on. You've got this fanatical audience outside. You've got police, fire crews there. We've got multiple witnesses. Stuff's happening all over the place. How quickly does the local police department latch onto the hoax explanation? Because it seems to, this seems to be to the untrained eye, Bill, or anybody who doesn't know the case or hasn't taken the time as you have and some of the other researchers involved at the time did, to see that this just carries on. But the official explanation that gets released by the police department is it's a hoax. She's admitted it, even though, yeah, come on, there wouldn't be a 21-year-old woman able to flip a fridge over, never mind a 9-year-old girl. How quickly do they come out just to try and kill it?
It was relatively quickly. It was basically from Friday to about Tuesday is when they announced the hoax story, and that's when they effectively killed most of it. They at least were, but they still had to maintain the police there. The police were still called. They still had to come there because, you know, the thing didn't end, yeah. But they did effectively get rid of a lot of the people who were just not going to go away. They didn't want to keep the street closed forever too. So they did do that. But it was pretty quick they jumped on the hoax story because this thing was just, it was getting out of hand. The longer it went unexplained, the more attention, of course, it got. So that's why they had to kill it in that way. And it, you know, it effectively worked for the city, didn't work for the family, of course, because they were still stuck with the poltergeist. But, and that's when Boyce had come in.
Yeah.
Because they ended up kicking the Warrens and Paul and every and Father Charbonneau. They ended up kicking them off the property after begging them to come back the next day. So the police must have really had a talk with them, and they must have reluctantly agreed, not knowing what else to do. Hmm. But they did go on an interview afterwards to establish a few things, that they're not crazy, that Marcy didn't do it, and that it was real. So they did end up backtracking their story of a sighting with the police. They didn't say Marcy did it, but they stopped the Warrens from being there, and of course the Warrens come with publicity, so that was the other side of the police thing, is get rid of the people, get rid of everybody, and, you know, and we'll announce it's a hoax, and that ended up on their lap. They didn't think of that themselves. That was the result of the two officers going in on Tuesday and seeing Marcy kick the TV. And they said, "Marcy, I saw you kick the TV. Why'd you do that?" And she said, "I wanted to see if the demon would do something," or, you know. And that was it. They blamed everything on her. But those guys weren't in the house any other time. So they weren't there during any of the stuff that was happening. So when they called that in, and the chief knew it wasn't a hoax, you know, but when he had that fell on his lap, that seemed to be perfect. As he told Jerry Sulfin, one of the investigators, he said, "You know, I'm sorry, Jerry, but, you know, we did the best we could with what we had. You know, we had to put an end to it somehow."
I mean, how do we know officially how long it carried on after this sort of mass panic of the first few days?
Yeah, they were doing the interviews during all this time, so we do know what was happening after that time and through Christmas and into January. So we do have a timeline of what had happened. One of the weirdest things that happened around Christmas time, well, Jerry put the tree in a cement bucket and wired it to the wall.
I mean, I don't care. Under any circumstances, does that seem like normal behavior unless you've got a real problem going on? I've never heard of anybody putting their Christmas tree in.
Yeah, if you're faking it, you don't do that. You know, and this, of course, is after it was announced the hoax. That's the thing. The majority of interviews with Jerry and Laura was after it was announced the hoax. I mean, they did some before with Ed Warren, but I mean, most of them were done with Boyce Beatty and Jerry Sulfin, and that was after it was announced the hoax. So there was nothing in it for them because they had an agreement with Boyce that he wasn't going to release any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons the story couldn't be told till after they were deceased anyhow, is because Boyce did promise him he wouldn't go make it all public.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he was there to help the family and to gain, the information for the investigation too, of course. But the hoax story worked well. And then after that, they were still having some activity. And during Christmas time, one time they came home and all the bulbs were off the tree in a pile. So that was one of the events that stuck in my mind. That kind of freaked Laura out for sure. But, yeah.
That cat, it's very talented, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it must have been the cat, yeah.
I suppose as well. I mean, you can kind of say it. You can bookend it. I think you've got the incident at the school, and Marcy getting seriously hurt. And then does she end up going to a different school and everything seems to settle down?
Yes, that's actually what really ended the poltergeist. With all these cases, you have to break that frequency, as you probably know. Father Doyle, who was called in by the fire department, he was the fire department chaplain, and he was called into the house. He ended up brokering a deal with St. Patrick's Church to give the Goodens a grant so they'd be able to afford to send Marcy to St. Patrick's school, which was successful. And the teachers were nice to her and the students were nice to her, and it fizzled out from there. So, yeah, that's all it took was for her to get settled.
I suppose as well, I mean, as you said there, that Bryce obviously made this promise to them, but they'd also had to get a lawyer involved. Because I think, you know, as we've touched on, the Warrens were not known for shirking publicity if they could get it, as some of their more numerous cases. And obviously this predates probably their most infamous case, which would be Amityville a couple of years later, which was entirely, you've got the book, you end up with the film. It's synonymous by the end of the 70s. Everybody knows about the Amityville horror by 1979, by the time the film comes out. So for this case to have gone on 5 years before and be completely brushed under the carpet, Bill, it just shows you the lengths they had to go to, primarily probably to protect their own sanity as well as Marcy and defend themselves. Because I know they said that the Warrens couldn't use their names and talk about the case in books or lectures or any. It was basically a complete suppression of any discussion about this case outside of anybody in that house.
Yeah, they were trying to do some things with privacy with the lawyer. And actually, that lawyer thought they could make a lot of money by doing it. He was going to get them gigs and interviews and whatnot. And, yeah. You know, they had no interest in that. But, I don't think the Warrens used their name. They did lecture on Lindley Street a little bit later, you know, later on. But, you know, I know they're controversial, but I could say in this case, there was nothing horrible or out of the ordinary done. It looked like they did a decent job in comforting the family and telling them if there's too much activity in a room to everybody get up and go to a different room. Yeah. So I think they did a good job. They were there a good amount of time through that hellish weekend. And I think anybody would have got kicked out, you know, because, I mean, Paul was hugging him the night before and promise you'll come back. And then they come back and he gets kicked off the property. So that was, and then Ed didn't know why until on the way home he heard a broadcast of them announcing it was a hoax and that Marcy did all the things.
Well, Lorraine got injured as well, didn't she? Did she get burnt by something?
Yeah, Lorraine got burnt, spontaneous burn. And that was actually recorded on tape because Ed was going to interview somebody and he had the play and record press. And then it was interrupted by this incident where Lorraine burned her finger and the police officer and Paulino looked at it. And, Paul said, yeah, it definitely was a burn. And I trust Paul. So, not that I think nobody would have a reason to make anything up with Lonely Street. It was enough of its, it had enough in it on its own without, any need for anything else. And I've heard the Warrens lecture on Lindley Street, and they've lectured it accurately. They didn't embellish anything or say anything that was against what I found in my interviews. So I just don't like to think of this as their case. You know, I think way beyond that. But I did want to address that because I know some people may not, either people love them or hate them. But in this case, I think irrespective of them being there, this case, stands on its own. And I just want to say that their involvement in this case, they didn't do anything wrong. I mean, other than calling in the AP wire. But like I said, I'm sure it would have gotten there anyhow.
Yeah.
But, you know, calling in and letting in reporters probably would have been against what, you know, I would have done in a case like that. Although people were already outside the house. And, you know, I mean, the press was already there when the Warrens got there. So they didn't invent it. But but naturally, they did interviews on it. At the time it was happening. And that was another reason why, of course, the police would want to get rid of them, too, because they're going to be talking to more people.
Yeah. It seems even after all this, though, you've got this rather frustrating incident where the family have had enough and they try and sell the house. And it seems that, obviously, they can't. So they go, oh, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll get rid of these swans that everybody's chipped bits off. And Jerry gives it a lovely lick of paint, changes it all, and they think, brilliant, we've got this sus now, nobody will remember this. And then they look in the local paper, and it's in the news. Haunted house repainted. What?
Haunted house, newly painted, haunted house. Yeah. I know, you know. I was shaking my head when I was reading that, because I'm like, oh, the poor, you know, it goes through the trouble to paint the house, and now... at least I got a shiny coat of paint. But yeah, it caused more attention instead of less attention. But yeah, they couldn't sell the house. I think, you know, the asking price was too much on the house, even without the poltergeist. And then, and then when you add the poltergeist in it, it's not a big seller. No, definitely not.
I suppose when you came to look at this, then obviously after all this has happened, obviously things seem to settle down after that bit. I think that's the last sort of public appearance the house seems to make at that period. It's almost everybody sort of moves on, and that's forgotten about. When you went back to speak to some of the people there, were you surprised how honest and candid they still were about this case, Bill? Do you think that these people had lived with this for 40 years? And thought, thank God somebody's going to take me seriously, because I'm sick to death of people thinking I was involved in a hoax.
I didn't see people feeling that they were involved in a hoax. I think they understood, you know, the context of, you know, why that story was given and everything.
Yes.
They knew, I knew it was real. And I was very surprised that they told the exact same details. I mean, I had the original interview and then I had the new interview, and just detail by detail. Tim Quinn, for example, WNAB reporter who saw Marcy get flown from the room. I mean, he described it exactly. You know, I had a dead on view of Marcy. You know, it was exactly the way he described it when he first was interviewed, and they all described the details the same. And for some, it made a lasting impression. And for others, you know, life went on. I don't really think about it. Or, you know, people are weird. You know, for some, it was horrifying. And for others, it was fascinating. And for others, they don't think too much about it. So that was really strange for me to find out. Yeah. But it depended on the witness. But for example, one of the ladies I interviewed was in high school at the time. And I heard her on the original tape. They didn't interview her. They just said, you saw it, right? And she's like, yes, you saw it, Susan. So I looked it up. And, you know, her mother had since passed, but she's alive. And I interviewed her and had her tell me what she saw from her perspective. And I went back and compared it to what the other witnesses said at the time. And, you know, it all matched up. And she thought it was fascinating because the TV didn't fall down. It went slowly. It like let itself down, I remember her saying. And that's what the other witnesses were saying, too. So it was interesting connecting with some of the people who were there that were younger that weren't interviewed at the time, and, you know, being able to interview them. And then some new interviews came forward thanks to social media. I mean, Facebook was a big help with, you know, I dated the chief's daughter and, you know, that. Yeah. So, you know, when you count in secondhand witnesses, geez, probably at over 120. And if you count firsthand, there's probably over 60 or something. It's just an incredible amount of people involved in the story. It's almost like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, you know. You can go 6 degrees of Lindley Street and you find somebody who was there, especially if you live anywhere around here. But even if you don't, it's just amazing the family members that have come out and the children of the people who were there that have come out. And it was nice. I provided them some of the interviews that here's the interview your husband you know, gave for this, you know, so that was pretty cool. Oh,
yeah, I suppose that's quite nice, isn't it? Because, I mean, like you say, it's been so long that perhaps you forget about the people involved, I think, sometimes in this kind of case. And that's one of the things that shines through your book is that the family are the centerpiece of this, regardless. You've got everything going on around them, this maelstrom of chaos and publicity and allegations and heinous, you know, accusations towards Marcy. On top of everything else this family's gone through in 10 short years, essentially. Regardless of the ghost and the poltergeist haunting, you've got a lot of emotional trauma in this family anyway. But for some of these people whose parents and grandparents, partners were interviewed at that particular time, they probably have moved on. They've passed away. And so they didn't have any recordings of their voice because they may have passed away before we all had a mobile computer in our pocket. So we had a tape deck at hand to record their voice. And I would imagine some of those people have never been able to listen to their departed loved one speak properly.
Right, right. No, that's true. And some people didn't speak publicly about the case to their friends or family, you know, depending on how they felt about it. I know there was one police officer who... he was the only one who refused to be interviewed. And his brother said, I'm sorry, he just won't. It was Carl Leonzi. Mm. He's deceased now, unfortunately. But he refused to ever talk about Lindley Street. So that's must have definitely had a powerful impact on him.
Well, as you were saying earlier, some people found it fascinating. Clearly he didn't.
Right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It didn't affect him, but he never slept with the light off ever again.
Right, right. Yeah, I would say most found it to be fascinating. Things happen so quickly, as you hear a lot, things happen so quickly. So, you know, you're more shocked than scared. Mm. Yeah, most were fascinated mm-hmm. by it. I know with the one of the firemen who went and brought his two sons with him, the wife wouldn't go. She thought he was nuts. And he brought the kids with him. The kids thought he was nuts. And then the kids saw the refrigerator move. And he said, well, now you saw something that no one's ever going to see. But the funny thing is, you can't tell anybody about it. Nobody will believe you.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. I suppose we would do this a disservice before I let you leave, Bill. Obviously, the family eventually move away. Things seem to settle down. But it seems that whatever went on in that early few years clearly affects Marcy a great, great deal, sadly. Because she seems to just get away from them as quickly as she can, it would seem. It's almost as if she wanted to disappear. I mean, we'll never really know what happened or why she went, because I think it's one of those things that you share the signatures from the Christmas cards that are sent. And I think the first one sent Christmas 75 and it's got all the family's names in it. And then by 1980, I think it is, it just says Godwin family. And there's no individuality there. Do we know when the family unit breaks down and Marcy just goes?
Yes.
Or is that lost to the mists of time?
No, we do know. When she turned 18, she left. And the reason she gave for leaving to her half-sister was because of the mother. She didn't get along with the mother. The other reason, I think, which is what she did not discuss with them, was she didn't talk about the incident at all. So I think another reason that she wanted to get out of Connecticut is and go to college in a different state was obviously the public still was very much aware of the house and her. She was called the poltergeist girl. Mm-hmm. So by the time she was 18, yeah, she wanted out of there. And that's when she left. And in the obituary, because Laura died in a car accident, and I think it was 93 or something. She died in a car accident. And there's no mention of Marcy in the obituary, you know, survived by. And same thing when Jerry dies, no mention of Marcy. So evidently whatever happened, it was a falling out. And I'm sure she never spoke to them. She didn't speak to them after that, which is sad.
It's deeply saddening. It really is. You know, you understand, we can look back at the situation and clearly you had two very desperate women here for very different reasons, Bill. You've got somebody grieving on the loss of their beloved son and coming through, as I said, dealing with having a tumour removed. You've got a child given up for adoption who seems to be listless, without sort of a tether to the world to hold him. But you would say on paper it's a perfect match. And unfortunately, you can see the animosity there. I mean, it's even mentioned at the time, I think the father says to Laura at the time, you're hurting this child. She's like, no, I'm not. I love her. I just want to protect her. I love her. And he's like, you can't. What you're doing is damaging this child. And she just won't have it. And so people say, oh, well, they were lovely parents. Well, it's one of those you think they are. But clearly what was going on, this overprotective burden, had just strangled Marcy to the point that it completely turned her against her mother.
Oh, yeah.
It's heartbreaking. It really is. And it gets even worse because obviously Jerry and Laura both pass away. There is no mention, as you say, in the obituaries about Marcy. Marcy sadly passes away far too young. Far yeah. too young. And it seems that all this trauma, I mean, it's one of those things you could look at situations and the way children were brought up 50 years ago, Bill. I think we've all grown up through an era where things these days are very different to how they were for kids in the 70s. Oh, it's heartbreaking. I must admit, it's not very often books move me to tears, right? But I have to say, when I found out everything that had gone on and how it ends, there was a tear in my eye because it's not what you want for anybody involved in this. Because
that's true, yeah.
They'd already lost enough and they were all given a second chance and it all goes horribly wrong. And then, if anything, they all had to carry that with them for the rest of their lives, bless them.
Yeah, I agree. It was it's sad the way it ended up. And not that it wasn't predictable, but, I had, even before I found out, I figured she had left when she was 18. Yeah. But then I got confirmation of it. And like I said, it wasn't too surprising. It wasn't too surprising that she stayed in Ohio after college and didn't want to be in Connecticut. There would be no reason to. Mm-hmm. And she changed her name to Jean, which she went by for most of her life. So, yeah, it caused her to do that. It would have been wonderful to hear her thoughts about it, but she never mentioned it to the biological sisters at all. They read my book in Canada and said, this sounds like Jean and it looks like Jean. And they contacted me and that's how the whole thing started. That's actually how we got Marcy's ashes back to her to be buried near her biological mother. And the full update is in the new, yes, the new photo and archive guide. Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose there is a small comfort out of all of it. If you hadn't written your book, Bill, her family would never have known it. And they're reunited because of what you've done, which I think you should be applauded to, because you've, if nothing else, you've given Marcy some peace in death, if nothing else.
Yeah, I felt wonderful about that. I mean, the coroner took out an ad because there was no next of kin. They couldn't find anybody to claim the ashes. And it was a reader that contacted me saying, hey, look at this. This sounds like Marcy. So I called up, I had her social and everything. So I gave all the information to the guy and says, yes, this is her. And And so if no one was going to take the ashes, I was going to take it.
Mm.
And then another family member was considering it, but ultimately didn't feel right about it. And then that's when I ended up finding the connection with the biological half-sister, which was a very nice ending to an unfortunate story. We find a lot of frontal lobe issues in these poltergeist cases, you know, mm-hmm. like she had epilepsy and multiple sclerosis. And we find that we have some of these issues in cases of poltergeist cases that we know of anyhow. Yeah. It seems to be a number that's oddly a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember speaking to Dr. Barry Taff a few years ago, and he was talking about the number of poltergeist cases he dealt with where epilepsy seemed to be involved.
Yes, epilepsy in particular. Yes, that's what I found too. And just like you hear a lot of sensitives have fibromyalgia.
Yes.
And yeah, so, you know, but yeah, it's unfortunate. It must be from being around that energy like that. Must have something to do with it.
Mm.
I mean, that's not a brain trust answer, but that's... Yeah, it must have something to do with it, yeah.
There has to be some kind of physical reaction to this. Because like we say, as we've mentioned, if we're talking about powerful energies of any description, it's going to cause a physical reaction in some level, isn't it? It's only natural.
Yeah, yeah. And we all know there's dangers of EMFs, so those electromagnetic frequencies, which, you know, the paranormal seems to... be heavily mixed with. I mean, those things cause all sorts of problems. I had a case where no one would stay in this house. They would run out of the house. And one guy came in there, family member, otherwise peaceful. He just went berserk and took a sledgehammer and was whacking the walls in the basement. It was really an interesting case. So, I got there with Shane Saroy. I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he's a great guy. And we both went to the house, and we found that there was a pipe not grounded correctly that was causing intense EMFs. Mm. And the lady was like in shock because her husband had died of tumors. And she had all these issues, you know, physical issues and stuff. Which hopefully have gotten better since she's, you know, left the house.
Yeah.
But even the people were doing some repairs in the house, left their tools in there. There was an insurance adjuster that or inspector that showed up and went in the house and went out and said, I can't go in there. There's something really bad in that house. So the frequencies were off the roof. So, I mean, we know that the frequencies can cause a lot of problems and even, of course, create the environment to invite something real in there, too. Mm-hmm. So something could have been in there. But the house being unoccupied when we were there, there was nothing there.
Well, it's an incredible body of work. I mean, the level of detail, as I said, the amount of analysis that's gone into this, the fact that you've gone back, you've spoken to as many people as you can, you've put Marcy to rest. I don't think there's much more you could have done in regards to this particular case. I mean, since you've written the book, obviously last year you released the companion 50th anniversary with additional details and transcripts of interviews and things like that. Has the Bridport poltergeist giving you a thirst for trying to uncover another case, or do you think that this is more than enough for one man in a lifetime, Bill, to deal with?
Oh, no, there's always more. No, and and you know, this case was, it's not that you need that many witnesses to determine whether a poltergeist case is real, of course, but this case in particular had to be told because I felt it was a story that reached beyond the normal paranormal reader. At least I had hoped it, because to me, this would be the book I would want somebody to hand me if they wanted proof of the paranormal. It's as close as you're going to get unless you're there and you believe yourself. which could happen, but you know, for many of us it's fleeting. As you know, you got to spend a lot of time before you get to the to see stuff. You know, it's not like in the movies. So it takes a lot of time. And the more skeptical you are, the less patience you have. So that's a problem.
So, are you thinking of doing a new book? I mean, obviously, as we've spoken, you've done two books about Bridgeport. You've done a couple of other books talking about ghosts as well. So, and both very fine in their own particular fields. You've got one talking about phone calls, which is one of those fabulous subjects I love about these paranormal communications. And haunted houses. So are you continuing to plow a furrow in paranormal literature going forwards, Bill?
Yeah. That's definitely what I enjoy, and I'd love to do something on. I don't know if there's enough for a book, but at least a chapter on these little things. I know Robert Ripley found these little skeletons of these little figures and stuff. Very fascinating. There's some fascinating stories like that. That and trolls. I had a troll case, and they were with one of my best friends from college, his wife's side of the family. You know, I mean, not saying that they're real trolls, but they described them as trolls or being very, very ugly. And I've learned of more cases about that. So that, I didn't think I'd ever hear another case like that, but the minute I had the one out, I started hearing others. So I'm fascinated to see where that goes too. But it may be a variety book of different things. We'll have to see.
Well, wherever you plan on releasing next, I look forward to it. But where can everybody find your books on the Bridgeport case, as well as your other articles, and keep up to date with what you've got going on online, sir?
Yes, you can go find my books on Amazon. I should be on Barnes and Noble too online, and that's where you should be able to order any and all of my books under William J. Hall.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links for everything in the show notes. And I just want to say thank you so much for spending so much time. And thank you for all you did in this case. Because I think often when people talk about poltergeist cases, they sometimes can just give us things that we already know and they just collect things. Whereas you went, well, I've got this and I want to know a bit more, as well as everything that you did for the family. And I think you should be applauded because there's not many people who would have done what you did to the level
Oh,
that you've
thank
done
you.
in regards to this book. So I recommend it highly. And I just want to say, I wish you the very best. I hope we speak again in future. And all you take care.
Yes, you too. Thank you for having me. Thank you, everybody.